Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I guess it's true. Good things come to those who wait. And North Carolina's Lumbee tribe has been waiting and waiting and waiting for 137 years for the government to grant it recognition. The tribe first petitioned the government for that recognition in 1888, but it wasn't just that the government was dragging its feet. There was opposition from other already recognized tribes. There are 55,000 members of the tribe in North Carolina, the largest in the state, the largest east of the Mississippi River, and the ninth largest in the nation. And federal recognition will enable them to receive funding from the Bureau of Indian Affairs for education, health care, and housing. Here to talk about that struggle, what this will mean for tribe members, and how soon these benefits may be realized is Dr. Ryan Emanuel. He's an associate professor of hydrology at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. Jesselyn Keziah is executive director of the Triangle Native American Society, and Dr. Marianne Jacobs is with us. She is a professor of American Indian Studies and chair of the department at UNC Pembroke, and all three are members of the Lumbee tribe. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, you're welcome. You're all members of the tribe, as I said, and recognition has been a long time coming, as I said, and though you knew it was coming, I think maybe a month or so ago, it was just announced, to the best of my knowledge, yesterday, January the 12th. What was your reaction when you knew that this was finally a reality? Marianne, I'll start with you.
Well, actually, we've been through this so many times. I was on a vacation, but I was watching folks in Pembroke via Facebook, because the tribe live streams a lot of things that were going on, and I was watching folks at the Boys and Girls Club in Pembroke watching the vote from the Senate on the bill. And, you know, like I said, that's a process that we've been through a long, many times. And so it's something that we didn't always fully have faith that it was going to happen this time. And I've always told my students when the Lumbee get federally recognized, but I don't think I was really prepared to actually see it.
And in fact, Ryan, when you were on with us in May, we talked about the possibility of this happening, and you were skeptical that it would happen. And is it because you've come so close so many times and only to be disappointed?
That's exactly right, Mike. My skepticism was my way of coping with all of these multiple rounds of disappointments through the years. So even as it was being voted on in the Senate, I was still not ready to celebrate, you know, until the bill was signed. I've just been through this process so many times just in my lifetime that I remain skeptical all the way until the bill was passed and enacted into law.
And Jesselyn, not only are you a member of the tribe, you are also the executive director of the Triangle Native American Society. So I'm sure that there was a reaction among members of that organization to this final announcement as well. What was that reaction?
Yeah, so we, Triangle Native American Society, we have folks from 25 different tribal nations who are members. We're an urban Indian organization, so we're intertribal, folks from many tribes. But we do have a ton of Lumbee folks who are here in the Triangle. And we tend to be very politically engaged, very active in keeping up with what's going on in the state legislature and nationally. And so I'll say there was lots of conversation, lots of anticipation in those final weeks in December with the Senate committee hearings and then the votes. And so even before more things were being announced publicly. We were receiving communication from our folks who were on the ground up in DC. You know, we think the vote's going to be tomorrow. You know, everybody stay tuned, and lots of anticipation there. And when the moment finally came through, we organized a last minute event, since so many of us couldn't get down to the watch party that Marianne mentioned down in Pembroke. We wanted to host a gathering up here, and we had about 70 people show up last minute to celebrate. So really, really exciting, like you said.
You mentioned that your organization, the Triangle Native American Society, is composed of people from various different tribes. Not all the tribes were on the same page when it comes to recognition for the Lumbees. Were there some people in your organization who are not blowing on party horns yesterday?
No. And we were celebrating back in December when this was moving through Congress and the vote actually came to pass. Right. We didn't have any local opposition within the organization that I've seen or heard of. I will say it's also interesting because the disagreements get a lot of press. And a lot of times those are coming from very specific leadership and very specific roles. And our folks who are on the ground in community, even between tribes who get a lot of press of being opposed, there's lots of close relationships between people on the ground and lots of mutual respect. So to me, it's really disheartening to see that type of press given to those to that fighting, to those voices, to those oppositions, because I think we're always stronger together, and we really see that tone in community of mutual support.
Was everybody in the tribe, in the Lumbee tribe, excited about this, Marianne, or were there some people who see some negatives in this recognition and what may come as a result of it?
I think everybody was excited about the possibilities. I haven't heard people expressing negatives around recognition itself. Some of the negatives were, as Jocelyn said, around the negative talk in social media from other tribes. Much of that is, some of that's not even real human beings, but some kind of automated
bots.
Thank you. There's just a very few very well-funded oppositional tribes, and the process, both through the BIA as well as through federal acknowledgement through legislation, is a political process. Right. And people in opposition can voice their opinion. And so there was a lot of that.
I mentioned, Ryan, that in the opening minute, which we don't hear for technical reasons, that the tribal territories are spread over four counties in North Carolina, Robeson, Scotland, Hoke, and Cumberland County. Is that where the bulk of the tribe lives? Are there people living in other close by states and other counties? And how did it come to be that it was primarily concentrated in those four counties?
Yeah, so those four counties make up the historic territory of Lumbee people as we were constituted in colonial times. You know, at one time, those were all part of colonial Bladen County, you know, which is one of those original divisions of the Carolina colony. But today, those four counties remain the residents of the majority of Lumbee people. And just to give you some brief context, North Carolina is a little unusual in the panoply of Indian country. Nationally, most American Indians live in urban areas. It's about three quarters urban, one quarter rural. But North Carolina, the ratio is almost flip-flopped, where we have the majority of American Indians living in rural areas. And much of that is due to the fact that many Lumbee people continue to live in rural parts of our homelands. But to your point, we do have a number of Lumbee people who live in places like the Triangle. In your area in Charlotte, we have a strong contingent of expatriate Lumbees. And then also in cities outside the Greensboro as well, of course, but also cities outside the state, including Baltimore and Detroit, we have sizable Lumbee populations.
So this push for recognition has been a long and difficult slog. It has been going on, as I said, for over a century. It started in 1888 with a petition that the tribe submitted to Congress. It was denied. Bills to appropriate funds for education were introduced in 1889, in 1910, in 1911. More bills came along in 1924, in 1932, in 1933. And then in 1956, the tribe received partial recognition from Congress with the passage of the Lumbee Act. But still, it was only partial recognition. Given that the state of North Carolina recognized the tribe in 1885, why? Why only partial federal recognition in 1956 and no real movement since then? Dr. Jacobs.
The federal government has historically gone through a lot of different phases in regard to their policy towards Native Americans. And in the 1950s, the federal government was hip deep in termination policy. And at that time, they terminated over 100 tribes across the United States. And that happened to be the time
What does that mean, termination? What does that mean they
termination means that the federal government was no longer recognizing the tribes which were terminated.
Okay.
And so those were tribes that the government considered sophisticated enough, maybe well off enough, maybe there were other reasons why those tribes were terminated. Many of the reasons, I believe, came down to the resources those tribes held on their land and folks who were petitioning for termination of those tribes. So that is the political environment in which the 1956 Lumbee Act was signed. When that bill came forward, the BIA said, this is the policy which you have to put onto that bill. And those two sentences, which denied us access to services, were added to our bill.
And the BIA is the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Jesselyn, she perhaps, Marianne perhaps alluded to one of the reasons why it took so long for this to happen, and that is federal resources, which leads us to my next question. Why has federal recognition been so important to the Lumbee tribe?
Yeah, well, federal recognition is important because it when we're talking about recognition, we're talking about the relationship between the federal government and our tribal nation, our tribal government, right? That is a political relationship. It's a resource relationship, and it honors the rights that were laid out in founding documents and along the course of American history that are intended to be designated for Native people. So recognition is the process by which we are able to have access to those rights and relationships that go along with those rights. So we were in a unique position where we were recognized in 1956 through the Lumbee Act, and then the next line of legislation forbid our right to access the resource relationships that could come along with that.
Go ahead, finish.
That's why you've heard everything framed in terms of the Lumbee Fairness Act, because it literally was striking out this one line of legislation. That's also a challenge where we had to go through Congress in order to amend that one line of legislation that had become federal law, which couldn't be done through an administrative process.
Jesselyn Kasai is Executive Director of the Triangle Native American Society. She's here along with Dr. Marianne Jacobs from UNC Pembroke and Dr. Ryan Emanuel from Duke University, all three members of the Lumbee Tribe. We will continue in just a moment.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the victory on the part of the Lumbee tribe in North Carolina. They've finally been recognized after 137 years of pleading with Congress to do so. We're talking about it with Jesselyn Keziah, Executive Director of the Triangle Native American Society. Dr. Marianne Jacobs is a professor of and chair of the Department of American Indian Studies at UNC Pembroke. And Dr. Ryan Emanuel is a professor of hydrology at the Nicholas School of Environment at Duke University, but also all three are members of this Lumbee tribe. Jesselyn alluded to the Lumbee Fairness Act, which is what has made this possible, this recognition. But it was folded into a must-pass defense appropriation bill, which is how a lot of things get through Congress. They are attached to bills that have to pass, and so if you vote one thing down, you vote the whole thing down. But this could have happened at any time. Why now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm sure there was a lot of behind the scenes work that I am not privy to and can't speak to. But I think the political stars aligned in terms of, you know, Senator Tillis's willingness to advocate for the inclusion of that bill in the Defense Authorization Act, which I have to say has been a successful strategy in the past for passing tribal legislation. My skepticism had been based on many attempts in the past to try and get this through the Senate as a standalone bill. And I think the political stars just aligned this cycle for that to happen, for this bill to be attached to that must-pass legislation.
You mentioned Senator Tom Tillis. He has been a big proponent of this bill, as you mentioned. But Ted Budd, our other senator, also supported recognition. And in the process, Tillis remarked, quote, that it's rare to see Republicans and Democrats come together on anything. But when it comes to Lumbee recognition, the support is overwhelming and it's bipartisan. How was this issue, which has been such a sticky wicket for so long, how is this issue something that has enabled the left and the right, blue and red, Republican and Democrat, to close ranks in one of the most divided times in our history, Marianne?
I think it's because of the longstanding poverty in our communities. If you look at Scotland County and Robeson County in North Carolina, I talk about it as trading the crown of poverty back and forth between these two counties. And this is generational poverty. This is long-standing generational poverty. And I think that both sides politically, the Democrats and the Republicans, have a vested interest in alleviating that entrenched poverty in their counties that they represent. Lumbee people are on all sides politically, and I hope that Lumbee people continue to be on all sides politically, as well as, advocating for Lumbee in addition to those other political ideas that they have for the United States. Now we have to advocate for ourselves. And we have been doing that historically. That's why we keep coming up asking the federal government for assistance. But it's this entrenched poverty that people really wanted to deal with.
Jesselyn, is this entrenched poverty particular to the Lumbee tribe? I mean, you represent in your other organization, the Triangle Native American Society, people in other tribes. How widespread is the problem of poverty among Native American tribes?
Yeah, well, it's certainly not unique to our tribe. And I think in general, when we're talking, we have to look at the history of disenfranchisement and resource extraction from our communities and the ways that our communities have been boxed out from.
Be more specific about that.
Yeah. So, well, there's so many ways that our communities and Marianne can speak more to the history than I can. I'm not really a historical expert, but overall, we know that Native people have been excluded from many systems and resources along the course of United States history, right, which started from taking resources, taking land, boxing out our communities into specific areas. So when we look at even the tribal territories, we know that many different people, many different family lines and kinship networks found refuge there in the swamps of Robeson County and surrounding areas, have deep knowledge of the land, are able to live off of the land, and are able to provide for ourselves and each other. Also a deep history of our people being entrepreneurs and relying on ourselves and on our internal networks for that type of economic development and lifeline. But certainly poverty is not unique to the Lumbee tribe.
So there was reluctance for 137 years among members of Congress to make this happen, but there was also opposition from other areas and other Native American tribes. Recognition, Ryan, has been tied up, and we talked about this, I believe, the last time you were on, in questions of identity. Some other tribal nations have been among the staunchest opponents of recognition. Why?
The reason why has to do primarily with resources, but you mentioned identity, and I think identity has been raised as an ancillary issue so that people don't have to frame their objection to Lumbee recognition in terms of a resource question. But to directly answer your question, you know, Lumbees in some ways don't fit the stereotypical notion of a tribal nation. Our identity as a collective was forged in this milieu of colonization during the 18th century. We don't come from one single historic tribal community that's not unique in the national scope of Native nations, but it is less common than present day tribes that descend from one single historic tribal community.
Yeah, there are arguments that because the Lumbee has no official language written or spoken, then that they're not clearly not a tribe. That has been the one of the arguments. The Lumbees have long claimed, as you point out, that they are descended from survivors of an array of tribal nations, including Algonquin, Iroquoian, and the Siouan peoples. That's how you refer to the Sioux Indians, who merged in the swamps around the Lumbee River. And one Lumbee historian says, "We are the survivors of centuries of decimation and conflict. We are the ones who remain." Meanwhile, the Eastern Band of the Cherokees say the Lumbees have a history of shifting claims, including claiming Cherokee ancestry and other historical tribes. Experts, they say, have repeatedly found that their claims cannot be verified through historical or genealogical evidence. What has been the response, Mary Ann, to that? And does the passage of this bill finally put that to rest?
Well, I think that those tribes are going to blow that horn as loudly and for as long as they possibly can. But I don't think it makes much difference anymore because this legislation trumps the BIA process to which they cling and to which, frankly, they control. It is not possible to make a genealogical path from our ancestors to individual people through the documentation to which Native people are recorded on, okay? Because by the time the United States was interested in documenting who was here in our tribal territories, they were not interested in identifying those individuals as Native Americans because of the fact that by 1790, the federal government was only really dealing with you as a tribal nation if you had resources that the government wanted. And we did not. Obviously, we were in a place where, you know, our river, our swamps protected us from federal removal. And that is one of the reasons why our people stayed here for so long. And so what other tribes say they want is they want this historical documentation that basically we come from people who were not literate by and large, who were not allowed to fill out the paperwork that was being compiled on them. And we're talking about census records. When a census record recording person came and did the census in your community, they looked at you and decided what to check the box. And there was only a limited number of boxes to check. And so people from our communities that we know we are descended from, because we have extensive oral tradition as about who married who and who had children for whom, those people turn up as different races in these censuses. So we have our oral traditions around who we're descended from and where we're descended from.
Has part of the problem, Jesselyn, been that the Lumbee name for the tribe was not even adopted until the 1940s? And there is this recognition among tribe members that you descended from Algonquin and Iroquois and Sioux. So how do you make the case that Lumbees are a tribe in and of themselves?
Yeah, so to me, it's very clear. We are a people who have been connected together, who over the course of multiple centuries, and it's very easy to follow that history, even when we're recorded from the outside under different names. So to me, I take a lot of pride in the name Lumbee and that our community mutually agreed upon that name as the best catch-all for a community that came from multiple different kinship networks with that came from different roots related that came together for that protection, right? We have been a consistent body.
Jesselyn, why that name?
Oh, for the river. For the river.
Okay.
And right. I would recommend Dr. Ryan Emanuel's book on the swamp, talking about the history of environmental justice in Indigenous communities. And he is a really has lots of profound insight into that history there with the river.
Dr. Emanuel has actually been on this program to talk about that book, among other things, and hydrology. He is the scientist among this group of people today. So let me ask you this. Couldn't this disagreement over lineage just simply be settled quickly through modern DNA technology?
We don't have the ability through what people commonly call ancestry DNA to trace genealogically back to the historic time period that is in question. This would be the early 18th century, late 17th century time period. That technology, frankly, doesn't exist. You can look at deep ancestry of people to see, you know, where your ancestors came from millennia ago, but this time period in question is not something that can be traced through ancestry DNA. And that's one reason why no tribal nation in the U.S. Uses this type of technology to establish their indigenous identity.
Marianne, opposition to Lumbee recognition from other tribes seems to stem in part from fears that there's only so much federal money to go around, and recognition of the Lumbee tribe might decrease the money coming into these other tribes because the pie can only go so far. Are those legitimate concerns?
No, they're not. They're not legitimate because the BIA gets appropriation based on per capita for the individuals to whom they are obligated to serve. And for years and years and years, the rhetoric of the pie can only be sliced so many ways has come out of the Bureau of Indian Affairs itself. They have been one of the main propagators of that idea that the Indian pie can only be so large. Yet we don't bat an eye when the federal government is engaged in political affairs across the world. We don't bat an eye at the proposed doubling of funding for the military. But we freak out when it comes to giving more money to Native people. And we all, you know, most people agree that Native people owned all of the land that we now call North America. And that at some point, the United States had to deal with Native American tribes. And at many, many times across the history of this country, those dealings were not good for Native people.
That was putting it politely. although opposition to the Eastern Band, by the Eastern Band of the Cherokees to Lumbee recognition dates back, I believe, to 1910, which was way before casinos came to be. Native American tribes, when they get recognition, have a certain amount of autonomy in terms of how what they can do on their native lands. And one of those things that they can now do is open casinos, which have become, at least the impression is, that they have become semi-effective generators of tribal wealth, Jesselyn. Could that have been playing a role in this opposition? They don't want the competition.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, we certainly hear about that, an economic argument. I think there is a level of threat because we are so large. I think there's a perceived level of threat just because we are so large. I will say Lumbee people are also powerfully educated, and we are spread everywhere over the United States. We've done a lot. UNC Pembroke started as a educational place for Lumbee people, and out of that, we've become a highly educated population, have folks in all sorts of different sectors. Physically, the tribe, the number of our members is so large, and we're also located in an area that's very convenient, you know, right along I-95, which has been this corridor between North and South. So there's lots of potential for economic development along that thoroughfare. And that's, you know, so often we hear the conversation framed in casinos, but to me, I see that as just a slice of the possibilities. There's so many different departments that the tribe has invested in and anticipation of this economic prosperity.
So there are 55,000 to 60,000 Lumbee people involved in all of this, and we're going to talk about what this recognition might mean for them when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their small classes offer a supportive learning environment where middle schoolers can develop curiosity and essential skills like critical thinking, collaboration, and problem solving. Details at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about recognition after 137 years of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina with Dr. Mary Ann Jacobs, Professor and Chair of American Indian Studies at UNC Pembroke. Jesselyn Kazai is Executive Director of the Triangle Native American Society, and Dr. Ryan Emanuel is an Associate Professor of Hydrology at the Nicholas School of Environment at Duke University. All three are members of the tribe. Recognition of the Lumbee tribe comes with certain needs about to be addressed. I mentioned in the opening that this means funding for education and healthcare and housing, and it gives tribe members access to certain college scholarships that they didn't have access to before. There are also certain rights to self-governance. Ryan, what does that mean?
Yeah, and you know, this is my gateway into this world of policy in the first place. I'm an environmental scientist, and my interests lie in the area of environmental governance. How do tribal nations and other governments manage their environmental affairs? How do we steward our homelands in simple terms? So there are a number of federal laws that have specific provisions granting rights to tribal nations when it comes to how decisions are made about land, water, and air in tribal homelands. These include things like the National Historic Preservation Act, which requires consultation with tribes prior to issuing any permits that could impact cultural or environmental resources that are important to a tribal nation. The Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act determines what happens to artifacts and even ancestral remains that are recovered during environmental disturbances. Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act have provisions where tribes can actually take on some of the regulatory responsibilities of a state in establishing their own criteria for pollution prevention. So there are all of these opportunities that are only available to federally recognized tribes when it comes to environmental stewardship.
And recognition, Ryan, means that this tribe will be able to create a reservation. Is that something you see happening? Is that something members of this tribe want to happen? Because from an outsider's point of view, there seems to be a lot of negatives attached to putting people on a reservation.
Yeah, you know, the reservation concept is a 19th century construct that was, and sometimes even prior to that, that was intended to confine indigenous peoples, imprison them on a certain parcel of land. In the 21st century, we think about this in terms of placing land in a trust with the federal government so that it is able to be stewarded in perpetuity by the tribe. Sometimes these are places where people actually live. Sometimes they could be more conservation land or culturally important lands that we want to hold in common. And an example for the Lumbee tribe would be our tribal cultural center, right? Which is not a place where anyone lives, but it's a place where we have cultural activities, where we have recreation, where we have a deep history of engaging with the land. And it lies right along the Lumbee River. So it's a culturally important parcel, not some place that we think of as a reservation, but it could be land that the tribe may want to place into trust for perpetual conservation, stewardship, and management.
And Jesselyn, with federal recognition, the Lumbees will now be legally allowed, because other tribes are, to sell marijuana, but only on tribal land. Does that then require the establishment of a reservation, because there has to be a tribal land from which to produce and sell it?
Yeah, I'll tell you, that's an area I have no idea about. Okay. The policies and ins and out. You know, of course, we've seen an example in Eastern Band and the facilities that they've opened, but that's not something that I know a lot about. And I'll also say, you know, any decisions in terms of economic development or departments are going to come from the tribe itself. I'm not on tribal council or within our tribal government. So I can't speak to their plans for.
Let's shift gears to something you might be able to answer. In 2022, there was a measure introduced in the House that failed to pass. But at the time, the Congressional Budget Office estimated the federal government would spend $250 million in providing health benefits to the Lumbee tribe members over 4 years. And tribal chairman John Lowry has said that he believes that health services will be the biggest benefit to this tribe through this recognition. How so?
Yeah, well, I think there's a that's an area that we can very clearly point to as a resource that we should have had access to all along. That's in that one line of legislation that was on the books from 1956, preventing us from accessing those types of resources. It's my understanding that as part of our negotiations, we'll have 3 years before we're fully onboarded into access to IHS services, but it will open us up to be on that list. I've also heard that we will be the chairman's update of recognition and the process. In his update this week, he shared that we will be on the list of BIA federally recognized tribes sometime within the month here of January. And so we should be able to see our access to certain benefits start rolling out.
Marianne, a woman named Gwen Locklear, who helped found the Triangle Native American Society and who pioneered the Wake County Indian Education Program, has said that the tribe, quote, has so many people who don't have health insurance. We have a high drug use problem. We have high cancer rates, diabetes, heart disease. But for the last 20 years, Americans of all stripes have had access to insurance from the Affordable Care Act, and recently Medicaid was expanded in North Carolina. Why has access to affordable health care and health insurance been so difficult for Lumbee tribe members?
I think it's historic because we have had a lot of folks who are in the construction industry. That historically has been a field that a lot of our people have gone into, skilled and unskilled area. And you have to be able to provide your own health insurance when you are self-employed or you're a member of a construction team that doesn't offer health insurance. So a lot of Lumbee people are employed in industry in which there's just not employment offered by their employer.
But they had access to the Affordable Care Act, to Obamacare. If they didn't take advantage of that, wasn't that their choice?
Some people felt that, and I've heard a lot of people say, you know, I went on the website for the Affordable Care Act, and I just couldn't afford what they were offering. So people made decisions, yes, about whether or not they could afford the health care that was being offered. And many of them said no.
So if they couldn't afford it then, they're likely not to be able to afford it now, Ryan. Things are changing nationwide for everybody as a result of the expiration of Affordable Care Act subsidies. So people on Obamacare are watching their premiums go up, sometimes to absolutely unaffordable levels. Will this mean, this recognition mean, that tribe members won't have to worry about that because they'll be transitioning to coverage from the Indian Health Service?
That is a possibility after this three-year period where roles will be audited and other certifications made. Having said that, there's a lot of criticism and critique of Indian Health Service, some of it unwarranted, some of it maybe has merit, but it's not a panacea. But it is possible that it will provide some relief to our tribal citizens. And I will say that we also experience a lack of sufficient facilities in our tribal homelands. You know, we have a lot of people who unfortunately continue to rely on emergency room as their primary engagement with medical care. And so it's possible that an Indian Health Service clinic or clinics could help to alleviate some of that pressure in the future.
As these Indian healthcare services become available, how difficult will it be for individuals to prove that they are officially members of the Lumbee tribe? I don't know which of you to ask that question. Marianne, you unmuted yourself.
I think it's not going to be difficult at all. We have a longstanding tribal enrollment system, and we have a lot of documentation about who's related to who. We do tribal descent, which means that you need to prove your ancestry to an enrolled member. And then we have a regulation that says you have to prove connection so that you've come back within a normal amount of time. You've come back and forth to visit with family, to renew your connections to our community. So we basically have those two standing things that tribal members have to prove. So I don't think it's difficult for most of our tribal membership.
I want to come back to casinos for just a moment because, Ryan, you wanted to make the comment that it won't be automatic. If there's a casino to come, it will not be something that happens simply because of recognition. What is the process?
Yeah, you know, in the late 1990s, when our leaders were writing what is now our our tribal constitution, they had the vision or foresight to write into that constitution a very specific provision for casinos. And it said, should the tribe ever be completely recognized by the federal government, we may not pursue casinos without a positive referendum vote by the tribal community at large. And you know, I'm gonna continue wear my skeptic hat here and say that we have a lot of socially conservative, lumpy people who have moral problems with casinos, and it's not. I'm not confident that a referendum would actually pass. I could be proven wrong, but that's my thinking right now.
Does anybody know if the casinos that are being operated by other tribes are actually benefiting those tribes to any great degree?
In a lot of areas, they are. But there's a lot of contingencies to whether or not your tribal casino makes money. You have to be in a good location. You have to be in a place where a lot of traffic is going back and forth all the time. You need a sufficient population of people to come and visit your casino. So some tribes are in places where they don't have casinos because economically it's just not advantageous for them to do that. We have had tribes who've had legislation and action taken against their casinos, for instance, in Texas, where tribal casinos have been shut down. So casinos are not automatically going to make you money if you're a Native community. But in the Lumbee case, we've already told you that, you know, I-74, I-95 crosses directly through our tribal territory. Other tribes have looked at us and said, those people are going to be the Las Vegas of the South. But as Ryan said, casinos are not automatic. The Lumbee tribe has to vote. It's part of our constitution. And there's a lot of people who feel a moral and a dignity to casinos.
I have about 2 minutes left. Jesselyn, I want to talk about politics because you brought it up and you were last on this program just prior to the presidential election to talk about the issues most important to Native American voters who are often overlooked by presidential campaigns. Donald Trump did not overlook you. He promised he would push for tribal recognition. And as a result, maybe not as a result, but certainly he carried 63% of the vote in Robeson County. I'm thinking, was that promise the reason he carried the county, or the fact that he carried the county the reason that he followed through on his promise? How do you see it?
I certainly can't speak to his intentions or what happened there. What I can tell you is that we have long had bipartisan support. We saw support from both of the presidential candidates through multiple of the last elections. I don't think that it's fair to frame our tribe's situation under only the current political context. I do think, to Ryan's point, the political stars aligning and the allies that we have had that have come forward have helped that momentum. And I'm very thankful that we were able to finally get this over the line. But I think that our bipartisan support has been very important up until this point. And I think it's going to be very important in the future that we have friends on both sides of the aisle. And that we maintain good relationships on all sides from the tribal nation's perspective.
This is a kind of a question out of left field, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because Donald Trump is musing about taking over control of Greenland from Denmark. And he said, and I quote, "The fact that they had a boat land there 500 years ago doesn't mean that they own the land." Well, the English came over on a boat to Jamestown 419 years ago. The Mayflower landed at Plymouth Rock 406 years ago, and the rest is history. Have tribal nations given thought to using that same logic to make the argument for taking the continent back? Brian.
I'm certain that many Indigenous people have thought about that logic. But you know, from a realistic standpoint, we're not going back to a place where North America is a 100% Indigenous a governed continent. That's just not realistic, right?
No, but you could run the place using that logic. You could run it.
There have been some serious proposals about where to start that, particularly with national parks. There's been some good commentary on having tribal nations manage parks.
Dr. Ryan Emanuel is Associate Professor of Hydrology at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. Jesselyn Kazaya, Executive Director of the Triangle Native American Society, and Dr. Marianne Jacobs, Professor of American Indian Studies at UNC Pembroke, all members of the Lumbee Tribe. That last question shows you that words matter.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.